Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk coming up.
These editions of The Russell Brand Show were undoubtedly gross breaches of the BBC's editorial guidelines.
The BBC back in the dock as the Trust delivers a stinging verdict on Manuel Gate. We'll have the lowdown on the tough new rules being imposed on risky radio programmes. Also in the podcast...
I always felt at the BBC, fairly or otherwise, that there was a certain equivocation about entertainment. It's one of the three purposes of the BBC, and some people frown on it a little bit and are a bit distrustful of it.
We hear from ITV boss Peter Fincham about life after the BBC, plus job cuts at the Indie, and John Gaunt gets his marching orders. It's all coming up in Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, we're trying to maintain a John Sargent-free zone here in the pod this week, but we do have a pair of Media Talk's dirtiest dancers right here in the studio. Maggie Brown is a columnist for Media Guardian. Is it the foxtrot or the rumba for you, Maggie?
Well, you know something? I just think people feel sad.
It takes two to tango, of course. Emily Bell, columnist for Media Guardian and the Guardian's Director of Digital Content, is here. You've been known to throw some shapes on the dance floor
in
your time.
And what's more, I've sewed them all on myself today.
Very good. Love the sequins. Now, never mind the fact that a grumpy old political hack pulled out of a second-rate talent show, the big news from Auntie this week concerns the BBC Trust's final report into the Russell Brand saga. Now, if you've been on another planet for the past couple of months, this is all about the lewd messages left by Brand and his co-host Jonathan Ross on the voicemail of the actor Andrew Sachs during Brand's Radio 2 show. Egged on by Ross, Brand discussed in graphic terms his sexual exploits with Sachs's granddaughter, Georgina Bailey. Well, never mind a slap on the wrist, the BBC Trust has delivered a right old spanking.
These editions of the Russell Brand show were undoubtedly gross breaches of the BBC's editorial guidelines. The offending parts of the programmes should never have been recorded, but once recorded, however, they should never have been broadcast. The Russell Brand breaches were all the more serious because of the misjudgments by those responsible for editorial control within the BBC. Indeed, none of the breaches the Trust is reporting today should have happened. All of them could have been avoided. The issue which links them is the lack of editorial judgment by those in control.
That was Sir Michael Lyons, chairman of the BBC Trust, giving his verdict in front of a tough audience, journalists, including many from the BBC. Now, not only were there serious issues, we discover, with Brand's Radio 2 show, but there was a rebuke for Radio 1 after Brand discussed his sexual congress with Georgina Bailey again, this time live on the Chris Moyles show. If that wasn't enough, the Trust slapped down BBC Television for allowing Ross to say to Gwyneth Paltrow that he wanted to, strong language alert, fuck her. Given these widespread failings, I asked Trust member Richard Tate, former editor-in-chief at ITN, whether there was a cultural problem at the BBC.
I think there may be a cultural problem in some parts of the BBC. I think that it's interesting that, if you like, post-Hutton, you get very few complaints, which we uphold, about BBC journalism. I think there are other parts of the BBC where compliance has not been taken sufficiently seriously, and the specific example of Radio 2 is a case where the compliance structure simply was not functioning as it should have, and serious editorial management problems there mean that it may be a special case, but I take your point that there may be another issue of culture more broadly in certain sorts of non-news and factual programming.
When you saw what had happened at Radio 2, when the details were presented to you, what did you think?
I was shocked. I'm afraid I wasn't entirely surprised, because Radio 2 had had some serious problems the previous year with fake competitions. And through the complaints process, we had become aware of concerns, particularly about compliance in the non-speech parts of audio music, and particularly in Radio 2.
If, as you agree, that there is a cultural problem in at least some parts of the BBC, does that mean to introduce a new culture, there has to be a new regime?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we have confidence in the current regime. We have confidence in Mark Thompson and his senior team. They cannot be everywhere. They didn't make the mistakes which resulted in this catastrophic breakdown of compliance. They have to trust and rely on their executives to do the right thing. And in the vast majority of cases, the people who work for the BBC do the right thing. And I think today, I suspect the people who are most disappointed and upset about this are not only the licence fee payers, but a lot of people who work for the BBC who have very high standards and are depressed and at another dismal example of mistakes by some, meaning the BBC's reputation is damaged.
Richard Tate there, chair of the Editorial Standards Committee on the BBC Trust. It's very interesting that unprompted he raised the issue of Hutton there. The Hutton report had a huge effect on the news division of the BBC. Could this have an equally big effect? Is it as cataclysmic, so to speak, for the non-news parts of the BBC?
Yeah, well, I've always thought that it was odd to conflate... it's not odd to conflate Hutton with this because the... potential reverberation and consequences for the organisation are the same. One came from an extremely serious route, one came from a relatively trivial route. But they both exposed in their own way the same issue, which is procedure and compliance, which I know sounds very boring, but actually if you're the BBC, there's a reason that we've always laughed at the producer guidelines at the BBC and their slightly finickety sets of rules, which we think, thank goodness, we don't have to apply by that. Those came out of a culture which recognise that when you're taking public money, you have to have different standards. And in the entertainment division, this balance of power between producer and talent has meant that those rules have been elided on more than one occasion, to the extent that you would put something on air without having listened to it, without having signed the forms, which is really breaches the code. And it's not a difficult decision to say this is completely non-compliant. Mm. But it's also about, this sort of what's the BBC going to do managerially to make sure that core competence is around editorial standards?
Don't you think one thing would be to make sure actually that you have people who control bits of the network that is sort of quite clear and they're not distracted by other things? One of the problems I'm sure here was that these very senior managers at Radio 2 were doing a lot of other things. I mean, Leslie Douglas was in charge of a great many of their music programmes as well. So it's very easy to actually take your eye off the thing that really matters about broadcasting, which is the broadcast service, the programmes that you actually put out. Do you know something? I don't think it's so much Hutton in the sense that Hutton really began as a furious government reaction. This is actually almost like a furious public reaction in quite large chunks of Middle England. And you actually look at the age of the people listening to Russell Brand, for example, they're 50 plus. So something actually wasn't right with the actual tone of the programme anyway, I don't think.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think that the BBC has to be all things to all people. Mm. And some people, like me, quite liked Russell Brand on Saturday night, very much enjoyed Jonathan Ross on a Friday night. Some people really can't bear them and, it's always subjective. So all these calls are subjective. So it's very hard to sort of apply a common standard, but that's why you have producer guidelines, because you know that there are certain things which you must not do.
Maggie, you were at that press conference. I was sitting there too. Were you surprised at the strength of the language coming from Michael Lyons and Richard Tate?
No, I wasn't.
Because it was very strong, wasn't it?
It was very strong, but I think that they recognised, if not, well, at Hutton, of course, we're still talking about, but they recognised that they had come to almost like a line in the sand, and they had to actually make sure that they were on one side or the other. And so they were treading this role as the trust, being tough, but trying to leave this decision about if and when you bring Ross back, up to the so-called executives. I thought there was an area where they were weak, and that was in talking more openly and candidly about the quality of their top managers, because we haven't mentioned yet, but none of them are going to be having bonuses, for example. But it's clear when you read the reports that people were on holiday, that not only was the director general around, but
they're all away in their villas in Tuscany.
And what's more, the corporate press office were advising Leslie Douglas not to actually put out this apology. So there are quite a lot of issues around the actual running the editorial responsibilities that people at the top of the BBC have.
This is very tricky for the BBC, because at all sorts of levels, it's such a Byzantine organisation anyway. But this report seems to have uncovered failings at one radio station, at another radio station, something over in television. The press office didn't react quickly enough, and at all sorts of levels, at all sorts of places, and that's really difficult.
But we all know that there have been problems with Chris Moyles, and that he is quite a high risk broadcaster. We know the same about Brand. We also know the same about Jonathan Ross. These were not, at one point, Michael Lyons said rather exasperatingly rightly that this was not rocket science. You didn't have to know that this was a potentially quite explosive situation, having Brand and Ross together in a studio.
So now, Emily, all high-risk programmes are going to go on a big list.
Yes.
Presumably, if Media Talk was broadcast on the BBC, we'd be on that list, I think.
I fucking hope so.
I've got in my hands a leaked document from the BBC, the updated audio and music compliance policy. All pre-recorded programmes must have a compliance form submitted. All pre-recorded programmes, in-house and independent, must be listened to in full by both the producer and a senior editorial figure prior to transmission. That's a lot of listening people are going to have to do, isn't it?
Yes, people are going to suddenly get very familiar with their output. I think it's a way of punishing Tim Davey and the other people at the top of radio by making them listen to endless hours of really quite tedious programming. Though there are low-risk programmes that you're not... I want to know what a low-risk programme is.
Yes, Gardener's Question Time?
Gardener's Question Time. Well, I think it's quite racy, Gardener's Question Time. There's some very blue jokes occasionally come out of that, about begonias and what have you. Possibly. This, as I say, feels like a punishment beating for senior management. But, of course, what's going to happen is that there's too many hours of radio to listen to.
No one's going to listen to all of that.
So, in fact, they're not going to... I do think that, actually, if you're the producer of a show, you really should listen to it in full before it goes out.
Well, I hope
so. That must be a minimum requirement for
the
job.
We obviously listen to all our programmes here on
I've been
Media
accused,
Guardian.
I've been accused of listening to myself at my desk, and I'm checking the quality of the output.
Is it dangerous that there could be an overreaction and all sorts of new bureaucracies put in place?
Well, I mean, what we've also left out there is that they're proposing spot audits so that you are never safe.
Will there be a hit squad?
Yes, well, it clearly looks like that. I mean, this at-risk
register... Is it like drug testing? Well, Tim Davey have to wee into a bottle so we can tell you've not listened to midweek this week.
But to be absolutely frank, they should listen to the programmes. I mean, this is just not rocket... This is, you know, just common sense. Of course they should be listening. The executive producer in the Brand case was actually his agent on the form. So, you know,
that's
lots
absurd,
of,
isn't it?
What I think is going to happen, and this is the worry, that because people are people, there'll be a special panic and chill over independently produced programmes. We all know the way the BBC works. So there'll be suddenly enforcers in studios where they think in the high-risk areas. That's I'm certain it will happen. In fact, I've already heard it from independent producers and in television too, that they are starting to feel that there's a tougher regime for them
than for the home-produced programmes. There shouldn't be a tougher regime.
I was phoned up yesterday specifically by a producer who told me that.
There should be the same regime, shouldn't there,
yes.
Emily?
Yes, there should be a regime. Yes. But I think I wonder if this is also a problem of the BBC being too big.
Yes.
And the fact that, you know, Mark Thompson can't enforce an editorial tone from the top or doesn't seem to want to is really the problem, as we've seen.
So, so Richard Tate says that there's a cultural problem, but can Mark Thompson change the culture?
It's an organisation now with 27,000 people in it, and it's got, you know, hundreds of different outlets. And part of it has been, well, we can't now. The editorial mission is very difficult for the Director General because actually the Director General can't possibly be across all of the output. Well, if the Director General can't be put across all the output, then surely his senior managers have to be across most of the output in their areas. If their areas are growing and growing and growing, they won't be across all the output, particularly if you're doing live blogs, if you're doing, you know, I say this with some feeling, if you're doing bits of kind of video and audio which can be lived onto a website without being fitted into a schedule.
Well, it says here that all the podcasts have to be listened to as well.
Oh,
in
God,
full.
Dear. Really? Blimey.
Yeah, I mean, it's serious.
They have to bring down responsibility back to editors, really. I mean, they have to break it down more. But those people have to clearly know what the policy is and then have a degree of flexibility. There was one...
Isn't it the case that what's happened here, really, talk about the cultural thing, is that the BBC has shifted away, you know, the metropolitan producers, the people who live in the sort of same you know, places that we do, they're out of touch with the audience and the Daily Mail readers who really feel that even though they quite like a bit of swearing now and again, things have gone too far.
But this is the problem: they're out of touch with some of the audience, and you've just described that demographic.
But it's quite a lot of people.
It is a lot of people.
Bakewell in the Guardian this week.
No, it is a lot of people, and I think that there is a sort of a 5-minute hate, quote George Orwell, 1984, around British television at the moment, which is and it is a lightning rod for kind of dissatisfaction with other things and stuff that's sort of going wrong more generally in society. But it does come back to this thing of, you know, is the BBC's output actually a bit too varied? You know, maybe it just isn't the place for edgy comedians. I mean, there was a time when somebody like Kenny Everett was on Capital Radio because it would have been impossible to imagine him on the BBC. But, I mean, the BBC can't bear to think of it going back to a time where it limits its output.
All right. Listen, also on the Trust agenda this week was its decision on the BBC's plans to put video news on a whole new series of local websites. In another firm judgment, the Trust shot down the £68 million plan, which had seriously angered regional newspaper publishers. Here's another BBC Trust member, Diane Coyle.
One of the first things we did when the Trust came into existence was ask audiences what gaps there were in their expectations of BBC performance. And one of the chief ones that was identified was regional coverage of the whole of the UK, all the communities in the UK. But we concluded that there was a mismatch between what the audience wanted and the means of delivery. In lots of parts of the country and for older age groups, there's an issue about broadband access and use anyway. Even for younger groups, the ones who were in their 30s and 40s were likely to be too busy to want to search out local news. Even younger age groups were likely to use broadband, but what they wanted was something much more commercial. They wanted listings, for example. And so we concluded in the end that the likely new audience for the service just wasn't large enough to justify the expenditure, that it wasn't good value for money.
Is the strength of your reaction to these proposals, the firm decision to say no, is that related to a desire by the Trust to flex its muscles, as it were, show its independence from BBC management?
No. These are evidence-based processes that we go through. We have a really, by now, rigorous methodology for assessing what the likely value to the public is going to be. My background is competition regulation. I'm an economist by training. And I think I'm rather proud of what we have achieved in setting up an independent, open, transparent public value test process.
Maggie, this is interesting, isn't it? Because with these two issues here, very firm judgments.
Emphatic judgments. On this case.
Absolutely,
yes.
Emphatic. This is not going to happen, this local news service. Is this the Trust flexing its muscles?
Well, this is the... Yes, I think it is, but I think...
To show that they're independent from the BBC.
Well, I think what I felt actually sitting there was that they could have interpreted the rules completely differently. Another type of BBC could have said, it's our duty to promote digital Britain and to create a broadband society. And if we do all this wonderful local content, which is going to appeal to older people, they will take up broadband. There was a way they could have gone, but they obviously did not want to go anywhere near that route. So their argument was, this wouldn't benefit the people who really appreciate local news. The £68 million can be spent better elsewhere. We're taking it back. The people who appreciate regional news want better regional news. We are not doing it. To me, it smacked of political decision-making, that they had riled so many important interests, of course, including the newspapers, that this was not the time to rubber stamp this in any shape or form.
And presumably, Emily, regional newspapers will be breathing a sigh of relief. But I don't think, do you, that the BBC pulling out of this market is going to save some regional newspapers from oblivion?
Well, I mean, you know, declaration of interest here. GMG, which is our ownership group, and its chief executive, Carolyn McCall, were fairly sort of strident about this in front of Parliament, as was Sly Bailey at Trinity Mirror, saying this squishes any incentive that we might have for investment in innovation around local newspapers. I think the problem, speaking, you know, as a journalist rather than a corporate entity, is that the BBC not being in the market doesn't guarantee, when you look at the balance sheets and the economic outlook, it does not guarantee that actually that money is going to come through for innovation, because, you know, it's going to be really, really difficult for companies to find money to invest. And you do wonder whether, in fact, we're going to be back here in a couple of years with sort of much more complete market failure at local level in terms of the provision of high-quality news services, and the BBC is going to be asked to be putting more... Now, you know, perhaps what the Trust has done is given us the right amount of breathing space to see whether or not we are now going to sort of see the things like... I mean, Trinity Mirror doing really interesting stuff, GMG doing really interesting stuff, but it's got to be sort of allowed to breathe a bit.
All right.
Emily, they were talking of 400 extra jobs and £350,000 per broadband website. I mean, it's a significant investment. It's also obviously a creator of jobs. I think the BBC will think long and hard before going back into this.
All right, more on all of this at mediaguardian.co.uk. I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk. Still to come.
Well, because you know we're in depressed times economically, therefore television needs to be full of happy smiley faces and needs to go all upbeat. I think it's much more complicated than that.
ITV's director of television, Peter Fincham, talks about credit crunch entertainment, and John Plunkett will be popping in to give us his take on the week's media stories. First, though, let's hoover up some of the other stories that we've missed from the past 7 days. Maggie, you started up the media section at The Independent, and the news from your alma mater is pretty grim, isn't it? 90 jobs going.
Yes, I mean, you wonder if it's going to be a newspaper at all. No, I feel terribly sad. I can hardly bear to look at The Independent these days. It's not, and it's a shadow of what it was. It just has to go on cutting and cutting. It's a tax loss for its owners. And we had this rather sad message from the Independent on Sunday saying we will still be a separate newspaper, which really said it all.
It's looking pretty grim for the Indy, but not just the Indy. Emily, you know, it's quite clear that all newspapers, regional newspapers in particular, we were just talking about national newspapers too, are in a lot of trouble.
Well, we saw a forecast, I think, this morning coming out saying there's 21% down year on year for 2009 over 2008 in terms of advertising. And you've seen really significant cuts, even incredibly robust and healthy groups like Associated, which are taking 300 jobs out of London. You've got News International, which has called a halt to its ambitious campus whopping project in the past week. And you've even, when you look more widely, you know, the New York Times' debt has been downgraded to junk bond status. You know, this is a real crisis. I mean, I don't want to sort of go on again about how many titles are going to shut, but, you know, it's not, to quote Michael Lyons, rocket science. This is going to be very, very grim, and titles are going to close and there are going to be a lot more job losses.
Well, if you've got anything to say on that issue or any of the other stories that we've neglected to discuss, leave your thoughts on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. We're into the home straight now. ITV launched its New Year lineup this week. There are some very exciting programmes, including the long-awaited UK spin-off of Law & Order. First, let's have a listen to the channel's director of television, Peter Fincham. I asked him whether the credit crunch was impacting on the creative decisions he's having to make at ITV.
I think it probably does, but I'm slightly distrustful of oversimplifying that along the lines of, well, because, you know, we're in depressed times economically, therefore television needs to be full of happy smiley faces and needs to go all upbeat. I think it's much more complicated than that. I think broadly people will watch television more in harder economic times, and there's a Thinkbox survey this week that suggests that commercial television is being watched 5% more than a year ago. Remarkable rise. So I think there's something in that. But I think it would be oversimplistic to think that we all sit down in Gray's Inn Road and think, right, recession on the way, what sort of programmes do we commission that suit a recession? I just think it's more subtle than that.
Perhaps cheaper programmes? Seriously, is there a pressure on budgets?
Well, I think it's right at any time, but perhaps this is put a little bit more clearly in focus, that we should seek to get the best possible value on screen to make sure that, you know, to use the old showbiz expression, the money's up there on the screen.
So you quoted the Thinkbox survey. You clearly don't feel that being the boss of ITV One or ITV channels at the moment is a position of managing decline.
Again, it's complicated, but I think sort of the opposite. I think that the figures that we see for really successful mainstream programmes suggest that people are liking them more. I'm a Celebrity this autumn is well up on last year. The X Factor's well up on last year. We're getting huge audiences to Big Football, you know, to Coronation Street at the peak of big storylines. I mean, there's nothing new about me saying this, because I think I'm consistent with what I said when I was controller of BBC One. Those people who think mainstream channels are kind of on their way out in a multi-channel world, they've missed the point. People like coming to programmes, you know, in large audiences. They like being part of audiences and having something they can talk to their friends about.
The thing with mainstream channels, the success of BBC One, partly down to choices that you were making when you were there and your predecessors, is that it has a clear vision of what it's about. Some critics might say that what ITV1 has lacked is a sense of personality of what it is about. Do you feel that that's something you can bring back to ITV1? And if so, what is ITV1's personality?
I think ITV1's personality is one that has been developed over many, many years. I mean, I think it's a perfectly legitimate thing to do to say, to compare mainstream channels, if you like, to national newspapers and say, well, you know, if you look at The Guardian, you'll find that, you know, domestic news, foreign news, art, sports, features. Pick up The Telegraph, you'll find the same. But one has a very distinctively different flavour from the other. And similarly, ITV1 has a different flavour from BBC1, but covers a lot of the same ground. I think perhaps we're more unequivocally in the business of entertaining our audiences. I always felt at the BBC, fairly or otherwise, that there was a certain equivocation about entertainment. It's one of the three purposes of the BBC, and some people frown on it a little bit and a bit distrustful of it. None of that at ITV. You know, we love programs that get big audiences and clearly go out to entertain them. So in that sense, you could argue that ITV1 is a more straightforward in its mission. I think that at any one time, the director of programs' job is to keep refreshing that, find new ways of doing it.
Peter Fincham there. Maggie Brown, you were down at the ITV launch as well. A busy week this week. What did you make of it?
Well, I thought it was a little bit downbeat, to be honest with you. I mean, Peter spoke well about the attractions of these super programmes, which are creating, you know, huge audiences for Saturday nights for both the BBC and, to be fair, you know, ITV with Strictly and an X Factor, and now of course I'm a Celebrity. But I felt that it was an edgy event.
It didn't feel very comfortable, did it?
It didn't feel like show business. It didn't feel like an ITV that was really feeling confident.
A really flimsy press pack as well.
The big initiative for next year is fighting fat and getting people slim and healthy in the new year. And I thought, well, got it. I've heard this about 100 times before.
I think he's done this before.
It has done it.
Remember those pedometers?
That was the Charles Allen initiative. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things was poor old Claire Sweeney, who we all know from Brookside. Oh. And it'll be all right on the night. She's supposed to be eating a healthy diet and presumably getting
fat. No, she's not. She's getting fat.
And, you know, this thought popped into my head, but haven't we all watched Supersize Me by, you know, Morgan Spurlock, and, you know, ruining his liver at McDonald's on our behalf? One of the problems is that there's about 13 or 14 new dramas, but we're not quite sure what they're going to be like. They're clearly playing with things that they know they can do, like computer-generated imagery on Saturday nights with a new show called Demons, and they want this gritty sort of messiah type stuff on Monday nights. But there was this sort of uncertainty about what a lot of these new programmes are going to deliver. They're still in production, a lot of them. And secondly, while he was talking, the chief operating officer of ITV, John Cresswell, was speaking in industry conferences saying that they may have to cut their production budgets, that they may have to substitute some of this drama for cheaper entertainment. So you do have a feeling this is not quite as happy a ship as it might be.
You watching ITV at the moment, Emily? Britannia High, you must be.
Britannia Low, no. Never. No, but I am watching I'm a Celebrity, which with the world's greatest athlete in it.
Brian Paddock.
Exactly, yes. Though I have to say, I've got a solution for them. If they want to watch somebody, you know, fighting fat, they could give me, in the new year, they could give me a camcorder on January the 1st. And actually, they could pay me, you know, 50 quid a week. And it would...
The problem is that Peter, because of the lead times in TV, he hasn't actually got any new initiatives that are ready to come forward. So it's a holding operation.
Yes, it's not his schedule. That's what I was going to say. It doesn't fit. It's not his schedule. It's very hard for him to be enthusiastic about it, I suspect.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
The pod has swelled to include John Plunkett as we're nearing the end of the podcast, the man behind Media Monkey. I hope you haven't found any BNP members living on your street this week.
No, I've been through the list. And there's no one there.
Excellent. Talking about nasty right-wingers, John Gaunt had to, of course, we're not suggesting that he's a member of the British National Party, but he did have to, he did get his marching orders from TalkSport this week.
There was an unfortunate slip of the tongue, which I think was his phrase, yes, when he accidentally called a London councillor a Nazi, but what he meant to say was health Nazi.
Right, obviously it was much better.
It is much better, yes, much more acceptable.
And not at all sackable.
No, that's right. It was a debate about children in care and whether smokers should be allowed to adopt them. And John Gaunt spent a bit of time in care as a teenager, so he had very strong feelings about this, but unfortunately so did listeners when he came out with this particular phrase. So we thought he might stay, but staff were told on Monday that he wouldn't be coming back.
So Gaunt is gone.
It's the second high-profile exit from TalkSport after James Whale. So we're not quite at the stage of who's going to turn the lights out, but they're losing a few of their more famous names.
Now he was not the only John to march off into the sunset this week, was he? What about that link?
I can't imagine what you're talking about. Yes, John, very good. John Sargent.
We've avoided this all pod long. But we should mention
we have to address this. I'm putting in my request already for my money back. From the various calls I've made.
Is this a serious... This is not a serious scandal. This is just ridiculous, isn't it, Emily?
It's pantomime! Yeah.
The idea that the BBC... that they have to refund everybody. Self-flagellate again, possible phone-in fakery nonsense here.
I think when Paxman turned up at the press conference, he realised that it was all a bit of a joke and that it wasn't really a proper scandal, so we shouldn't get too angry about it.
And also the fact that Jay Hunt was almost combusting with self-congratulation beside John Sargent. They couldn't be more pleased about this.
But has it jumped the shark, though? This is why I want to know. Everyone's complaining about Strictly Come Dancing now.
I fear the magic's gone a bit, yes. Because part of the fun is that you can't wait to see the person you want out be gone from the show. I remember it was Kate Garraway, Garraway of GMTV last year. It was perhaps the series before. And Andrew Castle was my particular bête noire, but he went fairly early on this time. So that was absolute pleasure. Okay. But you need the pantomime villain there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, anything else on the agenda of Media Monkey this week?
Well, I've been enjoying watching I'm a Celebrity because it's good to see a show that in no way threatens the future of the licence fee. No. So it doesn't matter what happens. I'm worried that Kilroy Silk might quit.
Who's your favourite contestant?
I think, it was until a couple of days ago. Well, now it's Timmy Mallett, I think.
Really?
The days of those of Whack-A-Day with him and Michaela Strachan. No jokes, please. On Saturday morning was great memory for me as a teenager.
You're looking, Emily, incredulous.
Bemused, yes. Well, one has to back Martina, don't you? She is the world's greatest living athlete, and the fact that she's very po-faced about being the world's greatest living athlete is tremendously entertaining.
Are you watching all of this? Unfortunately, I
was at this serious thing called the Grierson Awards last night, which is best documentary. So every night this week, I seem to have been out, I'm afraid, apart from watching
Maggie's
Devil's Horse.
Celebrating serious programme-making when you could be.
And indeed, I watched behind closed doors on Monday night, and that started and hit this. I'm afraid I've been very serious this week.
Emily, you talked over Maggie then when she revealed that the only night she was in, she was watching The Devil's Horn.
That says it all about the serious historical programming. I'm shocked that we've got somebody in the pod who has such a highbrow attitude to television.
I think that there's only one thing for it but to wrap it all up there. My thanks to Maggie Brown, John Plunkett and Emily Bell. Remember, if you want to give us feedback, head to our Facebook group or follow the official route at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. This podcast had not one but two producers this week. Ben Green did the good bits, and Peter Sale did the better bits. I'm Matt Wells. There'll be more Media Talk next week. Goodbye for now.